Hello, this is Nikki Creel from nikkicreel.com, and today I'm together with Tom Evans, the author of, I was going to say three books, but there's actually four books, because you wrote a novel first, didn't you?
Yeah, it wasn't a novel, it was actually a book of interlocking poems and life stories called 100 Years of Ermyntrude.
So where did your journey as a storyteller start?
I think it started when I was a child, actually. So I loved writing. But I had this unfortunate choice when I was about 13 of ditching the arts for science. So I ended up going down the scientific route. And it was only when I got to my mid-40s, when I got kind of bored by all this high-tech stuff I've been working with, that I decided to let the creative muse come out again.
So you became creative again, you found your creative side?
Yeah, and I'd always written poems. And when I write birthday cards and Christmas cards and things to people, instead of just saying "Love, Tom," I'd always put a little pithy ditty in there. So the first book, actually, the idea for it was I was going to write a story which was going to be the same birthday card, a birthday card to the same person all over their life. So by seeing what was written in the birthday card, you get an idea of that story, and that was the seed for the story. And it just took off and it went amazingly well.
I know that when you actually inspired me to start writing, which I had no intention of doing until I actually chatted to you and you gave me your Blocks book, as you know, we'll come on and talk about what Blocks is all about. But you gave me the book to actually have a read through, and you asked me to give you a review of it. And I suddenly found myself frantically writing, like intensely. Whenever I had a few minutes spare, I'd be scribbling on pieces of paper, and like words just kept on flowing out of me. So it was a very powerful book. What was the intention behind Blocks?
Well, Blocks kind of came from the work I did on 100 Years of Ermyntrude. So I wrote 100 Years of Ermyntrude without really knowing my craft at all. And then it seemed to resonate with a lot of people. What people then said was, well, Tom, you've written a book, I want to write a book, can you help me write the book? And I started to, as an engineer, I started to analyse what I'd done in 100 Years of Ermyntrude, and I went on some courses, I went on a hypnotherapy course, and I found I'd used hypnotic language, and I found out then how powerful using hypnotic language was. But when I wrote Ermyntrude, I didn't know that's what I was doing. It's just a natural storytelling technique. So when I did Blocks, the idea behind Blocks was all these people that came to see me, more and more of them seemed to have writer's block. So I studied what it was that stopped people writing. And it was nothing to do with their technical ability as a writer. It was to do with fears. It was like the apparent lack of time. Or people thinking, well, if I write something, people might criticise me. So all these old fears from their childhood would just emerge. And every single person that came to me with what looked like writer's block was really life block. So I wrote Blocks as a complete metaphor. So it really is a book about dealing with blocks that are life blocks, not writer's blocks.
Well, it's interesting because you've also got an acronym for Blocks as well, haven't you? So you played around with the word Blocks.
Yeah, the acronym always comes a bit later, though. And I always make them up.
You make them up afterwards. Yes. Now, in fact, you've got an interesting story to tell about how your last book is actually not your last book that you're publishing, but, you know, survive the one before your last book.
It's all very confusing, isn't it? It's all to do with actually the publishing industry, actually. What's happened with publishing now is it's really slewed in the favour of the author. Yeah. So if you've got a book written that's been edited and you can get like some stock photography maybe from the internet and do your own cover design, there's nothing to stop you uploading that book to a number of sites and having a printed book back within a few days. So the time lag between you writing a book, editing it and publishing it can just be a matter of days or weeks maximum. The issue is that the publishing industry hasn't really caught up with this yet. So if you get a publishing deal, which I did last year, the time lag between you selling your manuscript off and it getting published is something like 9 to 18 months. So ironically, I finished this book called The Art and Science Delightful Moments on the 28th of June 2010, and it's been published on the 24th of June 2011. And in that book, on the ninth chapter is called Flavours of Thought. So it's the different types of thought that we have. And I wasn't planning to write another book last year, because writing one book a year is pretty much enough for anybody. But the creative muse wouldn't lie down in me. And then in August, I wrote the sequel to the Lightbulb Movement book called Flames of Thought. And I published it in September. So the sequels got published about 9 months before the prequel.
Which is an interesting one. So is, and there, I believe there's another book bubbling away.
There's several, actually. And I always do this in all my books. I, at the very end of a book, I open a big loop to imply that a sequel is coming. And people like Dan Brown does this. So if it's good enough for him, then it's good enough for anybody, I'd say. So at the end of the Lightbulb Moment book, I remember the very last line, I say, when you have a lightbulb moment, for an instantaneous instant or moment, you are connected with the merged mind. And I'm going to write a sequel to that, which is called The Merged Mind. But actually, I'm going to write another sequel to the Flavours of Thought book called Loops of Thought. And I think the strapline would be something like untying the knots that bind us or something like that. And then we get stuck in the same thought goes round and round in our heads and what have you. And then if you're in a relationship or you've got, you know, Iran and America, that or you've got an industrial dispute where you've got the union and the management of you, one has one thought, that spurns another thought in the other one, and they get in this horrible knot and they can never get out of it. So this other book's going to be about how you get out of these knots in our minds.
Okay, so it's linking how the mind works. All of these are actually connected with your minds and thoughts.
Exactly, yeah. And thoughts, people say thoughts become things, but they actually are things. So what you think actually happens.
Yes, there's a lot of power in thought and exactly what thoughts are going through your head.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the statistics, but there's a tremendous number of thoughts that you just have every day, that you just repeat the same thoughts as you thought the day before.
Yeah, and the current human mind is only capable of having one thought at a time. So you're thinking something right now, and then you think of something else, then that thought will take over from the original thought. And if you think about the direction of thought, then you forget the content. If you think about the content of thought, you forget the direction. But the irony is that when you get into meditative state, and when you change into this sort of merged mind that I describe in Lightbulb Moment book and in the sequel, you can actually have more than one thought at a time. So we are capable of doing a lot more. And this is what the 90% of the brain that we don't understand or don't know what it's used for is designed for.
Which actually feeds quite nicely into, you wrote an article about the Trojan horse, or of writing stories, because that in some ways is going, two things are happening at once, aren't they? You're telling a story at a certain level, or the horse is coming in at a certain level.
Yeah, well, if you think about storytelling through the ages, it's always been about getting a metaphor across, another point across. So what you do is you tell a story like the prodigal son, which is like like some sort of fairy tale, but the point is all about forgiveness, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I decided that I've got a lot of amazing books on esoteric traditions and mystic traditions, and largely these have either been buried or hidden or ignored, or they're very hard to read. And so I thought it'd be a great idea to take some of this arcane wisdom and frame it in a modern day vernacular, but also give it a modern day context, so something you can do with it. So if I said to you that if you were an engineer and an entrepreneur and you wanted to have a really, really good idea and have the most amazing invention in the world, that the best way to do this is to learn how to meditate. You never put those things together, would you?
No.
Okay. The best way then is to learn how to breathe properly.
Yeah.
Right. And all these things are great, because not only do you learn a couple of techniques you can use in every field of life, but you become healthier and wealthier. You breathe better, you get more oxygen in your lungs, your body doesn't wear out as much, your blood pressure goes down, and you have a great invention. Who wouldn't want to do that?
I know, but it's something that people tend to think, I suppose it's the left brain, well, if you think of our new idea in a technical sphere, you're probably using one side of your brain rather than using the other side of your brain.
Yeah, and one of the things I do is I write about and I teach about whole brain thinking, how you get two halves of the brain working together and get one and one equaling three. And even if you look at all brain research and all neurological research, it's all left brain analysis of left and right brain. You can't analyse the brain from a left brain perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've got to look at it from a whole perspective.
Can't analyse it with the same thinking.
Yeah, and materialist science is completely left brain, so most of the research into the brain is left brain research into bits of the right brain. And modern day science has just missed the boat really on what's going on, because what's really happening is we've got two minds. We've got a left brain which deals with the physical world, and we've got a right brain which deals with the outer world, and they work together and they communicate together all the time. And inside the left brain, you've got a hologram of the right brain, and inside the right brain, you've got a hologram of the left brain. And they're connected together by this thing called the corpus callosum. Yeah. And the corpus callosum was thought that's the communication channel, when actually it's the block channel. It's the channel that switches the communication off between both of them. And the key to switching it back on again is the breath.
Just by breathing.
Just by right breathing.
Right breathing. Yeah. Not left breathing.
Right breathing.
Now, there's certain things that you've mentioned. I know you've spoken in certain language that maybe that I'd like you to pinpoint a little bit more, because you've talked about metaphors and loops and creating loops. And I thought it might be useful to just tell us what you mean by when you say use the word metaphor.
Well, a metaphor is a story. Mm. So really, if you take the book, so I've written a book on writer's block, which is really about life blocks. And what happens then is that book ends up in the creativity writers section. It's actually published by a publisher who specialises in books for authors. So it gets that message to a completely different audience.
Yeah.
The book on lightbulb moments is going to be read by people that are in high tech and entrepreneurs, people in business. But it's actually a book about how you connect with source and how you actually go through a amazing spiritual growth. Right? But it's a really practical book, because it's real world and it's got some great tangible outputs from it. And what I wanted to say is that spirituality isn't this sort of thing that we do on a Sunday,
yeah,
or things that it's got really amazing real world tangible outputs from it, but we're not tapping into it. And so why not tap into it? So and the metaphor there is the light bulb moment. You know, and I talk about Edison and talk about Newton and Archimedes and all these people that have had light bulb moments down the ages, and how that relates to our modern day life, and how we can have light bulb moments on demand by using some of these what look like arcane spiritual practices, which are basically just things that we've done all the time, but left brain thinking education has kind of switched off. You know, I think that every boardroom meeting should start with meditating and breathing.
Be very interesting to see what would happen.
Well, I've done it and it works really, really well, but only for companies that are really open-minded.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot missing in terms of when you get down to business, that you sort of tend to think more left brain, don't you, than right brain. And when, in fact, you should be using both elements.
Absolutely, yeah. So metaphor is important, and open loops are really important, and nesting loops are really important, because then that hypnotic language lets the conscious mind go quiet, and then you can get your message in and understood.
Very interesting, and I know that there's some loops within what you've been saying. I'm really curious to see what your next book will be, because you know you're not writing them. In fact, when you were talking about the order of your books, it reminded me of your mind maps that you do, and how you create the mind maps with a loop thing. And it'd be really interesting to find out exactly how you do that.
Well, mind maps are great, because they do let the left brain communicate with the right brain. I mean, the metaphor there, and it is a very loose metaphor, is the left brain says, I do the maps around here, leave me to do the maps. And the right brain goes, brilliant, the left brain's busy, I will sneak under its radar and I'll be really creative. But that's only a metaphor. But it's a great way of us understanding something very complicated like the brain.
And, I mean, it's definitely a skill. Is it a skill you think you can learn?
Absolutely, everyone would do it. All you need is pen and paper. Yeah. And in fact, if you try and use software-based mind mapping, often it switches the left brain back on, so it defeats the object.
Okay, that's interesting, because I know somebody said they couldn't, they struggled to do it until they actually used the computer program to do it. So that, you know, so it's an interesting thing that you've said there about mind mapping.
And remember, not everyone's wired the same way, so some people are wired in reverse.
So it might work for some people doing it electronically, and other people works better on pen and paper.
Exactly.
And so what's your next story?
I think the next story, I'm going to be led by demand, really. So I've got always got about 2 or 3 books on the go, and I've got them all mind mapped out, so I know what all the books are going to be. But I'm going to be led by reader demand and by publisher demand.
So basically, Yes, you want people to demand what they want to hear from you next.
Yeah, and also I can deliver, so they don't have to be books, they can be workshops as well, they can be correspondence courses, they can be one-to-one mentoring. So
I know we were running a workshop together.
On storytelling, yeah. And to be honest with you, the best way to deliver that is in that workshop format, you know, and if you just read about it, it's not the same as experiencing, is it?
No, exactly. Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said for experience, because I'm one of these people, when I read a book, if they say, do this exercise, I read through the exercise and go, oh yeah, I can see what they're trying to do there. That's as far as it gets. Mm. Whereas if I go to a workshop, you basically almost have to do the exercise, don't you? You're sort of given the time to actually sit down and have that experience, so it becomes more powerful.
Yeah, but you also get a great experience, a great feedback from the other people at the workshop, because they can act like sample customers, for example, can't they? And they can give you feedback real time in a very safe environment for stuff that you are trying out.
I think there's something magical that happens with groups of people, because more gets created than you could think of just sitting by yourself.
Well, I love the networking you have at workshops as well. I went to one last week, and there were, I think, 8 people there, and there were at least 5 new business connections from those 8 people. Right. And so you get the workshop content, and you get to meet some fabulous people, and they take you in new directions you wouldn't have gone as well. So I think doing a workshop a month is a good idea. Just do nothing else, just to learn something new and to meet some different people.
I know, I've certainly learned, for every single workshop I've done, I've learned something new. Mm-hmm. Because as the people who come to the workshops give as much to you as you officially teaching other people how to do things.
Yeah. So the workshop itself is a metaphor then?
Yes, actually it is, yes. Well, thank you very much, Tom, for taking the time to talk to me now.
Great to talk to you again. Thank you. We'll see you soon.